Thank you. I'm going to devote the next 17 or so minutes to... Exactly. That is my goal. That is my goal. I'm going to give you a broad overview of the various methods that have been employed over the past 5 to 10 years to study the inner structures of galaxies using strong gravitational lensing. And by inner structures, I'm talking about kiloparsecs, 1 kiloparsec, 5 kiloparsecs, 10 kiloparsecs. And as per the tradition, I will spend much of this talk highlighting some of my own work, but I'm sure that anything I leave out will be covered by a number of talks that are still to come in this conference. First of all, why are we here right now? Well, ultimately, it's because lensing is a great way to study mass. You know, one of the great problems in astrophysics is, what is dark matter? What are its properties? Well, we can learn a lot by studying the distribution of dark matter in galaxies. And a great way to do that is through gravitational lensing. Lensing is sensitive to all the mass that's in a galaxy, whether it's dark, whether it's luminous, whatever. So if we want to study dark matter, lensing is a very good way to do it. Additionally, gravitational lensing selects for us a sample of galaxies which are quite interesting. Due to their large velocity dispersions, most lens galaxies tend to be ellipticals. And the role of dark matter in elliptical galaxies has been somewhat controversial. There have been papers published in the last few years that say, well, of course, dark matter is prevalent in all elliptical galaxies. There have been other papers that say there's really no evidence for dark matter in elliptical galaxies. So lensing gives us a way to sort out these issues. Now, I would say that there are three primary techniques that have been employed to some success in studying the structures of galaxies using strong lensing. Direct modeling of individual lenses, synthesis of modeling and dynamics, and statistical constraints based on lens ensembles. I will spend most of my time talking about the first and third topics, since the second one, I'm sure, will be covered very thoroughly by Leon and Tommaso in their talks. So let's start with the direct modeling technique. What can we get out of this in terms of studying mass profiles? Well, the technique is very easy. We have some lens data, and we have some parametric model, and we constrain it using the data. But it's not hard to see that for most types of lenses, we don't get much out of direct modeling in terms of studying the mass profile. And the reason is that if we're going to use direct modeling to do profile studies, we really need two things. We need enough constraints to cover all the free parameters in our model, particularly the profile parameter. It could be a slope, it could be a core radius, whatever. The second thing is, you really need images to fall at multiple radii. That's kind of intuitive. If you want to study how mass is distributed radially, you have to make some measurements at different radii. So for typical quads, where we just have, you know, four-point images, that's great. We have plenty of images, but they're all kind of at the same radius. So that means that most quads are not so useful for studying mass profiles. Typical doubles, well, in a two-image lens system, you can have two images that are at very different radii from the lens center, which is good, but there's just not enough constraints in the typical double to really study mass profiles. So that's kind of disappointing. So in order to apply direct modeling to structural studies, you really need special types of lenses. And I'll go through some of those now. One special type of lens is, of course, one composed of multiple lens sources. And the prototype for this is Class B 1933. It's a radio source that consists of three components, and it's lensed into a total of 10 images. And this has been modeled by Joanne Kahn and Pepe Monios. And you can constrain a nice parametric model describing the mass profile. And they get a 3D profile slope that's consistent with something roughly isothermal. So isothermal would be n equals 2. So density goes like 1 over r squared. And this has been done in a couple of lens systems. Another way to use direct modeling with a special type of lens system is in systems that have resolved images. So this is a two-image lens system from class, B1152, But when you look at the images at high resolution using the VLBA, you resolve each of them into a core and a jet structure. This gives you additional constraints on the mass model. Essentially, it gives you constraints on the relative magnification matrix. And that breaks some of the degeneracies that you would otherwise suffer from in modeling a double. And if you just look over here, you see that we can actually do quite a nice job of constraining the mass profile of the lens galaxy in this system. And again, we get something that's very close to isothermal. And this technique, this special type of lens system, has been applied in a couple of cases. And you'll notice throughout this talk that I'm going to say the word isothermal a whole lot. The third type of lens system useful for direct modeling constraints is a lens with a central image. So this is J1632, which was discovered by Josh Wynn in his Southern Sky Survey. And we believe this to be the first galaxy scale lens with a central image. What's nice about this system is you get three images at three very different radii from the lens center, which means it's good for studying the mass profile. And if we apply very simple models to this system, we can get great profile constraints. And that's because the flux of this central image depends very sensitively on the profile parameters of the mass model. So if we model it with a 3D power law slope, we get a mass model consistent with something a little bit shallower than isothermal, about a slope of 1.9. And our error bars are almost embarrassingly small. But the problem here is that we can't distinguish a global power law model from a qualitatively different model, one where we have an isothermal profile going to a constant density core. We get great constraints on the core radius in this case, but we can't distinguish this model from this model. And obviously, that's disappointing because we would like to be able to discriminate between models that have very different behaviors at small radius. And that's kind of illustrated here, where we have a model that's isothermal at large radius, and it breaks to some shallower slope, beta, at small radius. So central images, again, this has been applied in really only one or two systems so far. So if I had an optical image here, the lens would be right about here. Perhaps I should have brought an optical image with me. So it's perhaps possible that in the future we will find central image systems where we can distinguish between something like a power law model and a core model. But based on my simulations, I'm rather pessimistic about that. But overall, there's about 5 to 10 lenses in which have some sort of profile constraint based on direct modeling. So that's one very important technique that we use for studying the structures of lens galaxies.
So what is robust about this principle? Is it a total mass of the human radius? Something must be conserved here.
You know, we've looked into that in great detail. What is constant among animals? And we don't have any great candidates for what is constant in terms of physical parameters. Of course, if we're going to reproduce the proper magnification of the central image, which depends very sensitively on the models, we have to pass the critical curve within some certain distance from the image to give it the proper magnification. This is something that's I think still a work in progress. We need some more theoretical understanding of central image systems and what they can actually tell us. You know, we only have one galaxy scale lens with a central image, so perhaps when we get more, that'll motivate us to do better analyses, and hopefully we'll go out and find them soon. So in terms of studying mass profiles, direct modeling is kind of a mixed bag, but you get a lot more when you add dynamics to the picture. And you're going to hear much about this over the next couple of days from Leon and Tommaso, but I'll just give you a one-slide introduction of this technique. The big idea here is that velocity dispersion is very sensitive to the mass profile under the condition when you have to normalize a given model to reproduce the aperture mass constraint that's given by the lensed image geometry. So if you imagine you have any regular old galaxy and you go out and you measure a central velocity dispersion, That doesn't tell you anything about the mass profile. That's because you have the freedom to take any mass profile you want and normalize it however you want. And you can reproduce the same velocity dispersion. However, in a gravitational lens system, you don't have that freedom. Any mass profile you look at has to be normalized such that it reproduces the proper image splitting in the system. And under those conditions, the velocity dispersion becomes a very powerful discriminator of what the mass profile is in the galaxy. So there is this survey, which you'll hear about more later, called the Lens Structure Dynamics Survey. And they've done velocity dispersion measurements on a whole number of lenses. And what you see here is, wow, we have a lot of lenses that look like they're isothermal. So this is nice because it's consistent with the results we get from just plain old modeling. So that's nice. So the third technique that I've introduced along with Chris Kachanik in recent years involves a statistical constraints on an entire lens ensemble. Our specific idea is to make use of very basic observational properties of the system, but combine them in a clever way to be able to constrain the sort of a global mass profile of the lens population as a whole. And our method makes use of aperture masses that you get just from the image geometry, and the basic optical properties of the lenses, such as their luminosity and their effective radius. This technique is nice because it allows you to incorporate large lens samples. You know, you don't need special lenses for modeling purposes, and you don't need to go out and get dynamical data, which can be very time consuming. And of course, it's based on very simple lens properties. The disadvantages of statistical models in general, of course, is that you can't say anything about individual lens galaxies. You can only describe sort of the overall properties of the population. So the technique we came up with, which I hope will get more interest in the future as more lenses are being discovered, makes use of aperture masses. So it's not hard to see how aperture masses can be used to trace the mass profile in the lens galaxy. Well, let's imagine we have a power law galaxy with a density like this, and we have a source behind it, and a source is lensed into an Einstein ring of this radius right here. Well, of course, whenever you have an Einstein ring, you know the mass enclosed, right? This lensing 101 here. But we can do a little thought experiment where we move the galaxy now to a different redshift. And now it creates a different lens, a lens with a different Einstein radius. And it's different not just in angle, it's different in kiloparsecs. Which means that as we move this galaxy around, we probe the enclosed mass on different scales. We can imagine moving this to a whole bunch of radii, getting the enclosed masses, and tracing the mass profile in that way. So that's the general idea. Of course, we can't do this in practice because we're not God and we can't move galaxies around. However, we can do something similar using an ensemble of lenses. What we need to do is we need to build a model relating mass to light. And so the simplest case is a homologous model, a self-similar mass model. So what this means is we can take the optical properties of the lens, pump it through our model to predict the mass profile for that particular lens. We can then see if that gives us an aperture mass, which is consistent with the lens geometry. And we can constrain global parameters of the model based on those aperture mass radius relationships. This should work because the lens sample spans more than an order of magnitude in Einstein radius with respect to effective radius. So our aperture masses probe the mass distribution on a relatively broad range of scales. The lens model we've used in this analysis is very simple. We have a luminous component for the galaxy given by Hernquist profile, some generalized cuspy CDM profile with inner slope n. And basically, we pump our optical properties into this model, predict the mass profile, and see if it agrees with the aperture mass that we get for each lens in our population. Well, let's just look at this panel right here, where we have a very large break radius for the CDM halo. So essentially, the CDM looks like a power law. And we show constraints in the plane of the CDM density slope and the fraction of dark matter projected inside two effective radii. Now, we do get some nice constraints, but there's a big degeneracy here. That's not at all surprising, since we're only sensitive to the total mass profile in these galaxies. And if we plot what the mass profile looks like for all of these favored models, they all look the same. So what this tells us here is that from the aperture masses alone, a very basic observable in a lens system, those aperture masses know that the mass profile is very close to a power law on the scale of several effective radii, and it's very close to an isothermal power law. And in the scale-free limit, we have a profile slope of 2.06 plus or minus 0.17, which again is consistent with all of the other lensing results. It's the total mass distribution. So So lensing really only knows about the total mass profile. So that's always what we're going to we're going to constrain best. Yes. But we can't reproduce our results with a model in which mass traces light. So that's given by this model, this side right here. The chi-squared falls very rapidly as you go to a dark matter mass fraction, a more distributed mass fraction of zero. We need at least 30% dark matter inside two effective radii. We don't get an upper limit on that number because the aperture masses are completely happy with having all of the mass in the galaxy in just some power law component. I'll skip the end and go to the conclusions. Well, what have we learned from all this? The most important thing is that lensing is really powerful. There are a number of techniques to employ on lens galaxies. They give consistent results about the properties of those galaxies, which is very, very nice. Our sample indicates through these various techniques that elliptical galaxies are nearly isothermal on the scale of a few effective radii, and therefore that dark matter is important, important contributor to the structure over the inner 5 to 10 kiloparsecs. Obviously, we would like to do more in the future. A good starting point would be more realistic galaxy models and perhaps including structural evolution in our analyses. On the observing side, of course, we need many more lenses of all types so we can apply all these different techniques to them. I'm very happy to see the great work done by Adam Bolton in finding 40 or 50 new lenses through his new spectroscopically selected criterion. And there's also going to be new instruments coming online which will help us to make use of the old brute force techniques for finding lenses. EVLA and LSST will be very powerful tools for finding lenses. I'm also cheered by the advent of new recording technology for VLBI observations, which vastly increase the sensitivity of radio telescopes, allowing much deeper searches for central images, which of course are another good way to study mass profiles. And of course, follow-ups are always going to be key. You could find all the new lenses in the world, but in order to turn them into scientific tools, you need really good imaging data, you need spectroscopic data. So there's certainly going to be a lot of cool stuff you can do with larger lens samples and a lot to keep grad students and postdocs busy well into the future. So thanks.
Thanks very much. Questions?
Greg Dobler. So in the central image systems, can you say a bit about how you know that the center image is actually an image of the quasar as opposed to just some radio source?
Okay,
near the center of the galaxy?
So in the case of 1632, we'll just bring that up again. We have radio spectra of these three components. They are in sufficient agreement in the sufficient frequency range, which makes us think that is a third image. C is a third image. A second factor, which I cannot discount, is if you asked me 5 years ago what I thought the first radio lens system with a central image would look like, I would have drawn something exactly like this. This is an asymmetric two-image lens system. It's the type that's going to most likely produce a central image. All the images are in about the same, about the right place that you would expect for a central image. The fluxes are look about right, and they agree with the models. So, in addition, when we published this paper, the HST imaging that was available wasn't so great. So we had a detection of the galaxy, but we couldn't say whether the galaxy was on the position of C or whether it was offset. Improved imaging has shown that the galaxy position is offset from C in the right place you would expect for this to be a central image. The galaxy is about right here.
And so that radio source is too far away to be some kind of feature of some active nucleus of some kind?
I wouldn't say with 100% confidence that this is a central image. As the old saying used to go, I would bet your life on it, but not my life.
Right.
But there's a consistent set of evidence which is highly suggestive of this being a central image. The ultimate test would be if we could measure correlated variability in the three components, and that would be a very powerful piece of evidence that C is in fact radio variability. But that's that test I think is a while off.
Where you see defeat in this, I see an enormous victory. You know, back when Ivan King and Francois Schweitzer were talking about cores, they were talking about cores of 300 parsecs. Now you've pushed the core down to 10 parsecs or something smaller than that, and you're still unhappy that you haven't made the core even smaller than that. I think you should look at the glass as being 90 or 99% full rather than 10 or 1% empty.
Well, I do remember reading those lensing statistics papers in particular that made use of very large core radii. And this is much smaller than anything you used to see, it's a very tight constraint. So I will try my best to improve my optimism, Paul.
Okay, in the dynamical analysis of the local ellipticals, we found a number of systems that had similar dark matter fraction within 2RE, like 30% or so. But we also found some where we couldn't find any evidence for dark matter, and it looks like perhaps there are some ellipticals which within those radius don't have any dark matter. And moreover, you might expect that the population changes a bit with redshift, because it's the sort of lower mass field ellipticals that get added as you come to the present by mergers and so on, and they tend to be the less massive, less dark matter system. So if that was the case, then how would this affect your statistic analysis? Would you measure a particular redshift range? Would you measure a particular mass range, or a combination of the two?
Well, the question you point out is brings up the limitations of doing a statistical analysis. Of course, we have some description of general properties of the whole population rather than individual properties of individual galaxies. When you look at the dynamical results combined with modeling results that have been done by the LST survey on these lens galaxies, just about all of them require dark matter. There are a few, such as PG1115, which has a rather steeper than average mass profile based on the dynamical constraints. That one is more or less consistent with something like a mass traces light. Also, from the results of individual lens galaxies that they have, what you see is there does seem to be a fair bit of dispersion in the properties. We measure average properties. it's probably much better to be able to look at n individual galaxies and, you know, make a little scatter plot. So I have no doubt that there's some that there may very well be some variation in this population. And you know, that's something that's going to be sorted out as time goes on. Did I answer your question at all? Or?
Not.
You mean? Well, of course, it is a bit of an apples and oranges comparison. You're talking about very local ellipticals. We're looking at ellipticals that are at roughly redshift a half or so, or perhaps even redshift one. So we have to be, you know, we have to be careful about what we claim in terms of it applies to, you know, intermediate redshift ellipticals. Still didn't answer. Okay.
Can I ask a related question, which is on in cases like this, in individual cases, you're limited by the mass sheet degeneracy, which is really a fundamental bugbear in this whole game. Does your statistical analysis sort of still suffer from that, or is it a way of taking it out because the mass sheet you would require would be different from galaxy to galaxy?
Well, the mass sheet degeneracy, if there is some distribution of mass sheets over different galaxies, they would all kind of systematically change the results in the same way, I suppose. Yeah, if you add a mass sheet, right, you tend to make everything shallower. So that's always a concern. No.
The segment changes.
Because in different galaxies, you probe different radii. And so. Any more?
Okay, then let's wait for coffee or tea. We're back here at 4:05 for the people who want to take part in the process.